This is Talk of Asian Marketing with a special emphasis on localized Chinese consumer behavior. Welcome to Talk of Asian Marketing, and today we have a little bit of a different topic, but still an important economic topic. A lot of money involved in this topic. But first I want to introduce our guest, and we have a special guest today, Michael Turton, who's been in Taiwan quite a number of years, and he runs a very popular website and blog. And the blog's located at The View from Taiwan. That's the name of it. And the address is michaelturton.blogspot.com. And very active. A lot of things going on there.
A lot of things going on there.
A lot of people reading it.
Mm-hmm.
I read it often.
Thank you.
And in fact, I'm going to complain because you fill up my RSS feed all the time. Damn you.
It's just my way of being noticed.
Very active blogger, very interesting and very influential. And I strongly, strongly suggest you take a look at that because it's not only news about Taiwan, but more important, it's very local news, politics, economics.
Yeah, I try to put a mix of everything in there, plus photographs. I have a very mixed audience.
A lot of photos.
Yeah.
A lot of photos. So we can click through there to your photos at, where do you keep your photos at?
Right now they're on Flickr.
Flickr?
Yeah.
So we can just click through and see them on Flickr? Because
sure.
I know you got a ton of photos.
Yeah, I got over 8,000 photos up on Flickr now.
Cool.
Some of them dating back almost 20 years.
So you put up your old photos?
Yeah, my old photos.
So you went back and scanned them?
Yeah, I scanned them.
Very cool. Very good. I strongly, strongly recommend that because one thing that's really good about Michael's photos is he really likes to get into the local street level, exactly what this show is all about, the local level. And those photos really tell that story. I really love your photos. You go to the night market, the morning market.
Yeah. I like doing things like walking into shops and photographing everything while the proprietor looks at me trying to form a sentence in English. Thank you, sir. Bye.
Just out of curiosity, because we shoot a lot of photos for the show, a lot of business-related stuff. We also have a thing called Consumer Cam. We go in and we shoot video a little bit secretly. So when you walk into some of these shops, because you really go right into the shop, do you talk to the proprietors while you're shooting? Or
No. I generally just walk in and start shooting. And usually what happens is they look at me in confusion because they don't know whether they should say anything. And of course, they're suspicious why someone photographing in their shop. But the kind of shops I go into are not the kind of shops that people are going to, you know, it's not like Costco or someplace where the competitor is going to be in there photographing. They're just ordinary Taiwanese shops, like the shops that sell daily goods for 99 NT each, you know, that kind of thing.
They're not exactly worried about
right,
the competition.
In other cases, I've already established a relationship. Like with the local buffet, I photographed everything in there. They had no trouble because they knew me. So, no, I've never actually been challenged except at when I tried to photograph inside RT Mart, the big French volume retailer. They clamped me down right away. But I've been going there 5 years, and the manager knew me, so he was really cool about it.
Yeah, we use our secret methods to get our retailing photos in the big stores like Carrefour. And James and I, we've had a lot of good luck with that also out on the street. We don't have much trouble. Once in a while, there'll be a proprietor who says, don't take my pictures, videos, and don't take the video. But besides that, it's not a lot of trouble. And I often find if you stop and ask someone first, it's more trouble
than if you just take the picture.
You find that too?
I find that too.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it often becomes much more staged as well, doesn't it, as people start to get things in order and move things around and get all up front and so on, and you never quite capture actually what you're looking for, which is something actually happening there and then in front of your eyes. So.
Yeah, all of a sudden they got to jump out and make a scene. And that person joining us is James Stanworth, a professor at Tsinghua Sifan Dashe over in central Taiwan. James, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks very much, Clyde, and welcome to our guest today.
Thank you.
It's a real little while since I took a look at the web site, but it is just so invaluable resource. I kind of said ages back that it ought to be almost compulsory reading for people coming to Taiwan because it gives such real good insights into the realities of teaching, working, living over here. I mean, some bits are a bit alarmist, but I think once you get into here, you can see the range of possibilities and how Taiwan really is so different. And I think that little bit of a wake-up call, because once the veneer sort of wears off a little bit, the web takes you right into the realities of what can happen in Taiwan and how it can be so, so different from working in the States or working in the UK, where things are so organized and regimented and where documents matter. Often documents don't matter here, and things happen in very different ways. And your web, Michael, really sort of puts a real exciting perspective on that. And I think it also gives so many practical little hints that takes the first timer right into a position where they can start off really comfortably with a good baseline level of knowledge.
That
contribution really helped me. I know it's helped a bundle of others. And
specifically, we should mention that's the website.
Yeah,
and that's called Teaching in Taiwan.
Teaching English in Taiwan. Yeah,
Teaching English in Taiwan, and that's linked in your blog.
It's linked on my blog, and it's on my domain, michaelturton.com.
Yeah, because if you Google Michael, you're going to come up with his blog. And that's a big thing. It's really great. But the other big thing that you would miss these days, because his blog is so big, would be his website. And we should mention that we have something in common, Michael, James, and myself, Clyde, and your website, because James found you through your
through my website,
Taiwan,
yeah.
And then he contacted me through you, so...
Yeah.
We all are related, including your website, somehow.
6 degrees of separation.
So, anyway, I just want to mention also, Michael's a researcher in Taiwan. He's been doing teaching in Taiwan for...
How long? 15 years?
15 years.
Yeah, all told.
All together. There was a... You were here in the early 90s then?
I was here. I first came in the late 80s, and I've been here off and on ever since. Went back to the U.S. to get a master's degree. And I started doing all sorts of... I started doing research for private consulting firms a long time ago. And been working on Taiwan and its and this world ever since.
Yeah, I've seen some of your stuff that you were working on before. And that was all related to the... When you're over in Washington.
Right? That's right.
And so you really early on were doing a lot of that stuff. And
A lot of that was technology policy stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Over at Roslin Institute.
No, that was... That was for a company called Washington Nichibei.
Ah, okay.
Which worked for Japanese.
Yeah. So you were doing stuff related to Asia early on.
Yeah.
Right. And I also know that you were in Africa for a while.
I was with the Peace Corps in Kenya.
With the Peace Corps in Kenya. And Kenya's... I've not been there, but everything I hear is
That's
beautiful.
A wonderful place. Not right now, but usually it is.
Yeah, not now. So anyway, that's you've been traveling around a lot, but you're not a traveler in the sense of a backpacker. I just want to make that clear. You've been here a while. You've been doing a lot of stuff related to business, related to teaching, related to research, and now you're doing some research in Taiwan. And so what we're going to talk about today, I think you're highly qualified. You've not been here a short time. You've been here a while, and I think you've really... done a lot of interesting stuff at a really high level. So, James, I'm going to just jump in here, and you interrupt me anytime you want, but I'm going to start with the history, and I'm going to go right to Michael, because he's been here a while. And what I want to talk about is English learning in Taiwan, because we know it's a market. And anyone who goes to Japan, Hong Kong, coastal China these days, and any place in Taiwan, and I mean any place, including the most outback countryside, you don't need to go far before you see a cram school. And the signs are right out there, cram schools, and you can even see the names of students who are getting what kind of scores and who got the highest English score on their entrance exam. So this stuff's been here a long time. But when you were first here in the late 80s, tell me about the English market then.
Well, at that time, the market was... there were a lot fewer chains, and most of the stores were one-offs run by people who had been spun out of other one-off businesses. I think the only chain at that time was Elsie. And so people started schools. School sizes were enormous. My school had, I think, 1,600 students at its peak.
Whoa.
Which is five or six times the size of the largest school you're going to find today. And at the end of the late 1980s, beginning of the 1990s, the chains all started to emerge. And at the same time, the bubble economy popped. And so the high growth period ended. And what happened at that time was, over the 90s, a pattern of perfect competition emerged, where all the teachers were making the same pay, and the students were all paying the same fees, you know, 48 hours, 9,600 NT, and the schools were all the same size. Nowadays, around every elementary school, junior high, and high school, you'll find cram schools. They're all about the same size. They have the same number of students. They host the same foreigners, many South Africans and New Zealanders now, and there were very few in those days. And they pay the foreigners all the same. It's a common complaint now among foreign teachers that that the South Africans are pulling down the pay rates. But really what's happened is these structural changes that have occurred in the English teaching system. At that time, let's see, other things that were happening. People were starting to develop better materials. You know, when we started working, the system was the very traditional system where the teachers would present, the students would go home, and then the Chinese assistant teachers would call each home. They would call every student and work on the phone. And that was a very common system used in every Busui band. But when the chains came in, all that got swept away. So they developed, each chain developed its own materials, but they're all pretty much the same. And it's an additional profit center, selling books, selling tapes. And what's happened now is that the industry has matured to the point where it's not very profitable for any particular person who's in it. There's a lot of the people I know who make a living do it by reducing their costs to the absolute minimum. They have an extra room in their house, and they teach 5 kids there, and that provides them with a small income that they can live on.
Which is kind of funny, because then it's kind of a cycle back to what it was. Because when I was here in the mid-80s, that's mostly what it was. It was a small scale, people doing it here and there.
Yeah.
And then your ones that were really businesses were, as you say, big. I remember I worked for, in 85, I was working for a company called Taipei Language Institute.
Sure, I remember them. Yeah.
And they were, they had their high-end business people, and they had their high school kids and all. And I remember specifically that I would go to work in the morning, like 7. I had class 7 in the morning. Why? Because they were junior high school kids, would come in for an hour before going to school.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't do that, but other people I
But you know about that, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And then, of course, at night you'd have your businessmen come in.
Sure.
Did you have some of those before?
I never taught adults. The issue with me for adults was they always canceled. You know, they were never stable.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to earn the big bucks.
Well, the big bucks, everyone says it was in the children's market.
Yeah, that's where it was.
And so I think like in the late 80s, this began to develop that the children's market was the big market. And I remember seeing a lot of small-time businesses, foreigners included, who would open up a small cram school, what's called a bushiban, right, in Taiwan.
Right.
And they'd open it up across from a junior high or somewhere, and you get all those junior high kids coming out in the afternoon, and they'd make good money. But then in the early 90s, mid-90s especially, the chains really hit that market
hard.
They
really killed it. Like the English school I was working at in the late 80s, when it peaked, then all the chains opened up, and it was in central Taipei. And all of the students who had been coming in from the suburbs quit coming in because there were English schools now opening in their area.
Because they were just chains.
They were just chains, just,
it's not very modular, and you can just franchise it out, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, the chains we're talking about, I think the one that I always saw growing so fast, Sesame Street.
Yeah, they were, at the late 1980s, there weren't very many schools, and the whole thing in Taipei was run centrally. I was working for them at that time, and they would send me out to different schools all around the Taipei suburbs. But then what happened was, of course, they opened so many stores they had to franchise.
Yeah.
And right. So I just worked for individual schools after that.
So you work for franchisee owners.
Right, you work for the owners, and of course you have the quality issues that come with the loss of centralized control.
Yeah, of course, every organizations like Sesame Street, Hess, what are some of the
others? Hess is one of the oldest ones.
Yeah, they've been around quite a while.
Jordan's, Joy, Giraffe, Kid Castle
Joy's,
now.
Joy's kids too, right?
Yeah, yeah, they're all kids.
Kid Castle, yeah.
Yep. I know
all these have just exploded like mad, haven't they?
They're everywhere.
I think as well that there was that strong government push for internationalization and the rising importance of, or seeming importance of English that sort of set the backdrop for this big explosion as well, where everyone sort of felt that, you know, English was going to be the big way forward, and people were sort of looking at Hong Kong and seeing the way that language was had been such a big doorway for success for that bit of the world. And I think it sort of provided the backdrop. And I think the government as well provided quite a lot of programs to support that in the way of funding for some of the small classes. In fact, my wife ran a class out in one of the sort of, well, I think they were called deprived neighborhoods. I'm not quite sure what they were actually called. And that was basically the government paid for her to go and teach the kids some English for a little while. And that was only a few years back now. But I think it all sort of fitted with that sort of government agenda on English, on internationalization. And a little while back, I remember them talking about changing the format for reports. So rather than being the horizontal style, they were turned into the landscape style, all to fit with the sort of Western style of a report. So it's kind of interesting, I think, the way perhaps that's a bit of a backdrop for the way all these schools have kind of exploded here.
That's an interesting point. And I think that certainly we're going to have a show on franchising.
Right.
Because it's just so huge.
Yeah.
In all of China, any Chinese culture you go to, franchising is just out of control.
Yeah.
It's just so huge. So that certainly play a role in how many of these cram school franchises you see, because they're everywhere. But I think James has a point. If you remember, Michael, it was in the early 90s, they were going for the ROC, Regional Operations
Center.
Sure,
APROC, yeah. And the APROC clock and everything. Yeah,
exactly, right. We were counting
down.
Where
did that go?
Oh. Right, and the idea was that when Hong Kong switches over, Taiwan will step up to the plate and take over the Asian Operations Center. And so, yeah, there was a lot of push on that. But, you know, when I was here in the mid-90s, 85 time, my first time here, everyone was English crazy already, I think. You know, everyone I ran into.
English, I think, is... you know, in Taiwan, when people talk about internationalization, really they talk about English. Mm-hmm. So at one university I was at, the department head came in to the meeting and said, we're going to internationalize our department. How are we going to do that? We're going to translate our website into English.
There you go.
So in Taiwan, internationalization practically means English.
Right. I think the interesting point here is, as we move on, you know, we see this apparent growth, and then the market maybe flatten out because you get a lot of supply. And then, you know, as Michael was saying about the pay, and James was saying about the government regulation, I think the biggest change I saw on the pay side was the government's involvement on getting the foreign workers into Taiwan, and that whole shift, which was around
1993.
Was it that early?
That's when they cracked down, yeah.
Didn't even seem that early to me. And you remember, every year they were changing the rules about foreigners coming into Taiwan, and then blue collar, white collar, and what does that mean, and all those things. And it seemed to me that there's some collaboration between the cram school's needs and the government's regulations. Because to get into Taiwan and be working at cram school, you have to get your contract beforehand, which means your pay kind of gets fixed.
Right.
And there seems to be kind of a cap.
Yep.
And I don't know what your salary was back then. You were in Taipei, so you should have been higher.
I made tons of money.
I was in Taichung. I swear the per hour pay I made then is exactly what people get paid today.
That's the same case with me. But then the NT was 24 to the US dollar, not 37.
Yeah. Well, it's creeping up a little bit now, but it's never going to be there again. Right? It's never going to make it back to what it was.
When the regulatory changes came down, you know, at that time, like, my wife was my teacher for my visa requirement. Things were so lax.
Very nice.
And then the government wanted to get more English in there, so the high schools, for example, the private high schools, a lot of them have English teachers now, and they are able to issue visas, but the public high schools still can't. So a lot of them don't have English teachers, or if they do, it's because they have an agreement with a Bushiban that provides them with a gray market visa. Yeah,
contracts them over. So yeah, this has been the changing of the market. I think is really the franchise has really changed the face of the market.
Really did.
But you know, at the same time, if we get on our motorcycles, which we always do, and drive around, you still see lots of those small cram schools. And these cram schools are specifically test oriented. My daughter goes to one. My son went to one. It's you know, every area around a school, you've got a bunch of these, and they could be just a guy owns one shop.
Yep.
It's like a breakfast shop. It could be a breakfast shop in the morning, and at night it's a cram school.
And it's
right?
An etching bank,
And you can they actually will have, now some places are getting real fancy now. It used to be they just draw on a big POP piece of paper, the students and the scores, their top winning students who got the highest score. Now I've seen LCD signs. Have you seen some of these?
Oh.
And students' names scroll across.
No, I haven't seen that yet.
Oh, it's really high tech. And this is up in the Chi Chi district. They have this, so a little bit higher. And they have these LCD things. They scroll and they say, you know, Chen Wuming, he got 75 and got into so-and-so high school. And, you know, so this is the kind of the badge of honor for these cram schools.
Right.
And so I've always thought that the real market, the really big market here, is test preparation.
Definitely.
Oh.
Yeah, all the cram schools. And, in fact, a lot of the... both at the high school and the college level. The college I used to teach at down south, for example, it was they taught nurses. And at night, the same teachers would teach essentially illegal cram school classes to their nursing students so that they could pass their nursing certificate degrees.
Right, right. It was all about passing that exam.
You got to pass that exam.
Right.
There's a huge market for that.
Yeah, and the exams, you know, so these cram schools, they'll have math.
Yeah.
English.
Yeah.
What's the really... But I'm going to... Here's the killer. The biggest one of all. I think the biggest topic in cram schools, the one that almost everyone takes, that would, I think, shock a lot of foreigners, Chinese,
yeah. Yeah. It's so important.
And it's so hard.
Yeah.
And they just get whacked on their test time after time. Those entrance exams, it's always Chinese that gets the lowest score.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a general perception you read in the newspaper all the time that the quality of Chinese is falling off over the last 10, 15 years.
Yeah, yeah. I think this is the general perception, whether it's true or not.
Yeah.
So these cram schools, that's a big economic sector. James, you want to jump in here a little bit? What's your impression of the economic size of this kind of market?
I've never checked the figures. I don't know if either of you have actually...
The figures are hard to check because, you know, so much of it's run underground. And even the chains, I think, hide a lot of their income even.
Oh, definitely. At all the schools I've worked at, not... underreported.
Well, it's easy for employees to tell because you get a lot of your pay will be underreported and you don't pay tax on it. And you know the boss is getting away with that.
Yeah, the only way, yes, is to go down to the sort of grassroots. So another typical problem here, when you talk to businesses, people say, I just want to get some accurate information. And that's real hard to do, even from the statistics.
Well, for anything,
since so much is cash reported, then it's really hard to get an accurate understanding of how big the market is. But
for example, all the foreigners you know, I mean, almost every foreigner we know is working in this sector.
Right.
Yeah, that gives some indication of size. And when you look at Tainan as a city of 750,000, and you've got around 400 foreigners here in the way of American, Canadian, and so on, then the majority of those are right into that sector. And on top of that, then you'll have the schools with local Taiwanese who are also teaching in the English sector. So the sector economically must be fairly significant. And when you look at almost every school kid, they'll have their class books for English, probably cram school English, in their huge book bag. So it's an indication that the sector is pretty large. Economically, I think it's interesting more to look at the sort of macro point of view. And Michael was talking earlier there about the increasing pressure and that bubble that we had in the sort of 80s, early 90s, where literally schools exploded everywhere. I remember coming over and you'd see one or two cram schools. The next trip I came, there'd be a whole street line with them, and they just are growing like leaves. But then the interesting thing is how recently the market has become so much more competitive. And in fact, the prices of English classes, I think I've heard reported, have actually started to fall. So that, I think, is an interesting statement about the degree of competition. And another interesting
is that supply side or demand side? That's really the key point I want to get at in this show. Is this supply side or demand side change?
For me, I would say that's a demand side change. But given the fact that there's, let's say both. Demand side, in that I think probably the market is now saturated in terms of people, that there is no more demand with a decreasing population of younger people. And then supply side, as Michael mentioned, hey, way back we never saw any Canadians. Suddenly there's all sorts of Canadians and South Africans everywhere, and they're taking my job. So So I think both sides of the equation have really moved up to the table here to sort of make the economic equilibrium much more obvious.
Yeah. And, Michael, what do you think, supply side or demand side?
Well, definitely, James is absolutely correct. There's fewer children now. And another issue is, of course, local incomes have been stagnant. Local incomes have been stagnant since, say, the late 1990s, which means that all those working class families that I used to teach back in the 80s no longer have the extra $3,000 a month to send their kid.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's the absolute money, but it's that psychology.
Yes, that psychology.
Because when your income was keep going up, and back in the early 90s, I'm not sure people's pay were going up, but all their property values were going up.
Right, exactly.
And so there was this feeling of, well, you know, buy some more, spend some more, put them in the cram school, no problem.
Yeah. There's that issue. And I think another issue from the supply side is that the universities have expanded, which means that there's a massive expansion in these applied English programs. And these applied English programs, one of their job markets is cram schools. So all these people, actually the vast majority of them are female, they're graduating, they're looking for work. A lot of them will go out and start their own schools, or they'll go to work in schools. And of course, there's too many of them, so they'll work for less. So there's a number of factors here that are pushing down the cost of English education, or the I should say the price.
Yeah, but I'm not sure I've seen the price go down a lot. I pay for my kids going to cram school, but they don't go for English. They go for math class and the Chinese class. So
computers too are another big cram school.
Yeah, computers, computer learning stuff. So these, and especially the Chinese, the English, the math is getting ready for the exam.
Right.
So I think the exam market, I always try to explain this in this way, and I'm not sure I can make it clear, but Taiwan's undergone this huge change, economic change. We've really moved into a kind of post-industrial, post-export economy, and things stagnate a little bit. People have pretty comfortable lives. I mean, come on, Mike, you got to admit, it's compared to the 80s, life is good today.
Yeah, sure is.
I mean, all you got to do is go visit China and go out to a little bit to the countryside, and you'll all of a sudden know.
You just got to go down to some place. Only remind, I won't say that.
But at the same time, there's that those groups of people who are still doing the exact same thing they were doing before, which is cramming to get into the best junior high, cramming to get into the best high school, cramming to get into the best university. And so I think that market's pretty constant. On the other hand, like when I was here in the late 80s, early 90s, a lot of my students were business people, and they were very anxious to learn that English. But today, those same people who would be 21, 22, 23, they're not here studying English anymore. They're over...
They're in China working.
China working.
Yeah, exactly.
And their biggest obstacle is to, you know, learn how to be, how to grease the palms. And
learn how to get along in that environment. Yeah.
Learn simplified Chinese.
Yeah, exactly.
Learn simplified characters, rather. So I had an interesting discussion with a salesman came to our department in my university, and he wanted to sell case studies from Harvard, video case studies. And it was expensive. James, you've probably seen products like this. They're just videos of, you know, CEOs and etc. The problem was, if you mention these companies to students in Taiwan, they have no idea what company you're talking about. It's lunar to them.
Right.
It's totally lunar. And, you know, FedEx? What do you mean? Xerox? Who's that?
Yeah.
I literally asked my students what IBM makes last month, and nobody knew. Now, given it's a little bit confusing, you know, lately, what IBM does make exactly, but still, they literally had no idea.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that what's happened was the international shift has moved from everyone's racing to that money that's an export economy in America to where the money is now, which is...
In China, yes, but if you look at the recent trade figures, Taiwan's trade is becoming a lot more diversified. A lot of it's going over to Southeast Asia, Middle East.
Central America.
Central America, yeah. So there's going to be demand for educational stuff that's aimed at those markets. And I think at the moment there's nothing fulfilling that demand.
No, there's not. But I'm not sure how many people got this straight in their heads. That's a good point. The biggest future market for Taiwan, supposedly, and I believe it's true, is India.
Yeah. I pushed that a lot on my blog. And I've been talking about that for years. Yeah.
But have you gone into class and talked to your students? My students draw
a blank. Where's India?
Yeah.
I actually had that. You know, students asked me, and I asked them, what country's right here? Yeah. That big triangle right there. How can you miss it? But no.
It's a very funny thing. So I think something's, you know, happened in the last 10 years that's taken the English market in a different direction.
Yeah.
I just think that a lot of young people today, especially these key points, and see what you think about this. When you got cable TV, you must have gotten in the early 90s, right? It was illegal, remember?
Sure. And you got everything.
Got everything. You did everything, and almost all of it was in English.
Yeah.
Remember Star TV from Hong Kong?
Sure. And we had ESPN in English.
ESPN. I used to watch college football games.
Sure.
Right?
BBC.
And now all of that, including channels like Discovery, Disney, is all dubbed in
Chinese. Yeah.
And you don't have a choice, at least I don't get one here, of using sub-channels.
No, that's one of the reasons we stopped getting cable, because the number of choices has declined.
Exactly. So I see this as being a little a metaphor or an analogy of what's happening in the wider society. My college students, I feel the same way, that at one time you had groups that were very anxious to learn English because they know they're going to walk into a trade company.
Right.
Now nobody thinks they're going to walk into a trade company. They all think they're going to get a service job down at the department store.
And they'll be CEO.
Or they're going to be a CEO of something. They're not sure of what, though. Or they're going to go to China anyway. And so, you know, it's a very different perspective. And so the test market is still, I think it's still exactly the same.
Sure.
But the kind of voluntary kind of wanting to do it because you're motivated that you're going to get something out of it, I just don't see it very much anymore. And I don't see it in my own students at school. And I don't see it in customers either when we do consulting outside.
Yeah. Well, I've noticed some of those same changes. Of course, your student population is a bit different than mine. So I would say that over the last 10 years or so, there's a lot more students going to college. And the average quality, the student motivation, student awareness of the outside world, all these things have declined. And ironically and paradoxically, this has occurred even as Taiwan has become more globalized, more connected to international markets, needing more people who will have a more experience of the world. But, you know, you ask your students, did you go anywhere this vacation? And they'll say, well, I went home. And they have money. If they really wanted to, they could get on a plane and go to India. Or they could get on a plane and go to Malaysia. They could get on a plane, go to Borneo or Guam or wherever. But they won't. They don't. They don't think that way.
Yeah. James, what do you think about that? You know, you've been teaching a few years now. What do you think about the international kind of perspective of your students there at Tsinghua?
Well, I think that's... I think Michael's really hitting the nail on the head from my point of view, in that there's a typical question that you can ask, say, a class of 20 is, who's been abroad? Now, you know, you might get one hand go up, and quite often you get zero. And if you get, say, five hands going up, then you'll say, and where did you go? And they might say, well, we went to Thailand. And why did you go to Thailand? Well, when we were undergraduate students, then, you know, we graduated, and for our graduation trip we went to Thailand. But of course then that's a graduate class, you know. Now then
they all go together in one big group, right?
They'll go in a big group. And
when they're on the street, they're actually, you know, one circle of students.
Homogeneous bundle. Yeah. So,
like Buffalo.
So, that's absolutely...
keeping off the predators.
So, now I come from UK, and that's not a very big island. It's a bit like Taiwan. So I'm well aware of how easy it is then to move into that sort of island mentality where, you know, at the end of the day, you can be king of a grain of sand and feel good kind of thing. Your world becomes as big as you see it, really. Yeah. And I'm equally shocked by how I can say, well, have you seen the troubles in South Africa? Who's running for president right now in America? And you get these blank looks, and you say, well, do you know who Nelson Mandela is? So, well, I'm not sure.
Yeah, but I'll bet they've seen all 200 of the Edison Chen sex photos.
So
that's that big thing in Hong Kong,
yeah.
That of course is...
I haven't seen any, by the way. Can we see them? Are they viewable?
You get arrested for that.
That's an absolute universal phenomenon though, isn't it, across the world?
Sex sells.
Don't know?
Sex sells.
people are going to sit up and say, what? No, I haven't. Please, can I? Or yes, I have. Or or go quietly pink in the corner.
Yeah, I wonder if this is kind of a, you know, just a kind of post-industrial trend, you know, kind of postmodern thing when you get into a certain economic condition and it's very easy to become insular. You know, the same is true in the U.S. You know, it's always funny. It wasn't an election or two ago. There was somebody running for president. I don't know if it was Kerry or someone. And they went to a factory and they were, you know, complaining about, you know, they're going to stop foreign companies from coming into the U.S. But the company he was talking at was actually owned by a U.K. firm. So, and everybody there owned their jobs to the U.K. company. So, you know, I think there's just something about that insulation that's happened. So I think this market, for a number of reasons we've covered, demographics, changing demographics, and right. I think this is really going to be the similar in Singapore. Definitely, they have the same exact problem as Singapore. Declining birth rates.
Sure.
Less and less young people. Mm-hmm. Hong Kong has this problem. China is a little bit different because of the way they've manipulated it, but I think you're heading towards the same thing in the end, which is families are going to be smaller. So on the one hand, you'd think parents would spend more money on their kids, but what do we see here is the money gets spent on...
Well, it's... I think the changes that we're going to see are...
Well, we were over at Tiger City a couple weeks ago shooting some video, and there's one place kids spend their money.
Yeah.
And you've been to Tiger City, right, in Taichung?
Right.
And you go into the retail area, if you're not just go to the movie theater, you go to the retail, and things are expensive.
Yeah. And that's an issue for the stagnant income thing. And a lot of people where I live, you know, where I live on Tanzi, which is a very working class area with a lot of small, you know, sort of car repair and things like that. Basic construction materials, all that stuff. Those people make, say, 30,000, 20 to 30,000 NT a month. They're never going to go to Tiger City.
So that's like, they that's buy like all their, $800 US a month.
Yeah. They buy their clothing in the night market. They get their food from the street vendors. They shop in the morning markets. They live a completely different life. And the key thing we're talking about insularity is nowhere in that life do they intersect anything globalized.
True. But their kids, I think their kids do come over to Tiger City once in a while.
Yeah, they might come over.
And I think, like, as a class, they'll go over with their friends once in a while.
Right.
So that's about as far as you get. So I think, in general, this English kind of idea, and I think a lot of foreigners got it a little bit wrong. They'll go somewhere, like they'll visit Taiwan or they'll be in Taipei, and they'll say, English is everywhere.
Yeah.
And so there's an automatic assumption that the American brands are here and everybody knows them. How many people out in Tunza are familiar with those American brands or even give a hoot about them?
None.
And then, of course, you don't ask, at the same time you see those American or European brands, you don't ask people at the Chinese brands because you don't know them.
Right.
But those are the brands they really know.
Yep.
So I think English is in this kind of case. As far as the testing market goes, I think it's pretty consistent. You still have those groups of people really fighting to get those test scores for entrance to good schools.
Sure.
Like your top schools.
Yeah.
And then as far as motivation is concerned, the economy's kind of smoothed out opportunities on all different areas,
yeah.
And I'm not sure English plays that big a role anymore.
So I think there might be markets for things in the high-end English applications, like, for example, students who need consulting services to go to universities overseas.
Well, it's the same. That's still the same thing. That's your testing market. So your TOEIC,
right.
Your TOEFL test. But have you seen the numbers on TOEFL? It's dropped way off.
Yeah.
And the GEPT, which is the local test, have skyrocketed.
Yep.
Right. You know, in the research I was working on that paper about this, that at Taida, that English department that gets the income from this, they're making millions of U.S. dollars
off this testing.
Off this testing, and it's huge. So you know, you get a kind of refunneling of those funds into the local English market.
Yep.
But then it becomes more and more driven towards those test scores, and less driven towards the actual use of it.
Yep.
So this is where I find the huge disconnect as a researcher, as a teacher, and as a user, I think, that in the West, where you have people like Crescent always talking about read for fun, read for entertainment, do it because you like it, motivation and intrinsic motivation, what we see here is more and more people being funneled into taking it more and more for that test.
Yep.
They even had to make it illegal for children under 12, I think, to take it because there were so many younger people being
right.
pressured to take the test.
Yeah.
So in Taiwan, they made a rule that you can't take it if you're not over 12, I think.
Yeah, I remember reading about that. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of, you know, it's nice to say that reading will been able to learn English, but I think I count on the number of my fingers in my hand, the number of students I've had over the years who actually read English for pleasure.
Yeah, and I think that I like to use this example, that if we were in the U.S. and we were teaching Chinese, or someone we knew was teaching Chinese, and how many of our friends would be reading Chinese for pleasure?
That would be zero.
That would be zero. And if they were all forced to because it's a required class, how many would like it?
That would also be zero.
Approximately approaching zero.
No,
right?
It's worse than that in a way. Many of my students at several universities have reported that when they speak English in the dorms, the other students get on their case for putting on airs.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Which leads me to what's happened at my school recently. We know at a lot of schools, your school and I think James at your school too, it's a general MOE, Ministry of Education policy. They were paying teachers extra to use English in class.
Right.
And so this was to encourage internationalization, the thing that...
Because internationalization is English.
Exactly what Michael was talking about earlier. And so they were pushing on that. And at my school, last year I was all of a sudden given a note that there's somebody who wants to interview me, and it was some kind of review. I thought it was from the MOE. Well, it was from the MOE, and they had different professors they pick. By chance, the person who interviewed me was the president of Donghai University.
Uh-huh.
He was appointed by a review board at the MOE to go check out how this money's being spent. And he didn't seem very happy. His questions were leading. You know,
right.
In other words, like, so what good is this? So what does this accomplish exactly? And I was very positive. I always very supportive of my school. You know, Michael, you have to be.
Oh, right? Sure.
Got to be very supportive in a Chinese culture. It doesn't help to be negative.
No, I've always avoided these interviews for that reason.
Everything's great. My school's marvelous. And now 1 year later, the policy has come down. The decision is made. The MOE is going to cut it out. And they're going to stop it. And I thought this is so funny because what you have here is money was being paid, not huge funds. You know, James, you know our pay's not high to start with, right? So so a little bit of money, you know, see, we're talking 50 to 100 U.S. dollars maybe a semester or something like that.
Yeah.
It's very small, actually. But this money that encourages teachers to use English in class is going to be stopped because the MOE has decided that it has no effect. Because they caught too many teachers that were taking money, but they'd go to class and not use any English at all.
Right.
Which doesn't surprise us, I think, right?
No.
James, you're not shocked, are you? I take that evil laugh as a no, I'm not shocked.
I've been in departments where the chairman was unable to speak English. So.
Right, and I've talked to other teachers about this, and I think, you know, it's that peer pressure Michael's talking about, because even teachers, if they go into a class and they're not a foreigner, quote-unquote, whatever that means, that the students will say, what are you doing using English?
Right.
Use Chinese.
Yeah.
And you say, well, because it's a literature class and comparative literature from the UK, right, English writers, that's why I'll use English. And they'll be like, yeah, okay, but use Chinese. And there's a kind of mentality that everything can be translated and just shifted over to Chinese. And I think the development of the commercial market, TV, you know, you turn on Discovery, you turn on Disney, everything's in Chinese.
Yeah.
So every Disney show that you've ever seen and that we go back to the U.S. and our kids like, they come back and they got it here, but it's all dubbed in Chinese.
Yeah.
And so this becomes this idea that there's an equivalency. And so, you know, they just tell teachers, what are you doing?
Yeah,
no advantage.
There was a discussion of that in one of the Chinese language blogs a few weeks ago. They were saying that the reason that Chinese think Western literature is no good is because, well, all the translations are awful. They don't read the original, and the translations are.
Yeah, right. Gotcha. Okay, well, I think then that kind of sums it up. We had a development over time. We have an interesting market. I think the lesson here, though, for marketers is you've really got to be careful. James, maybe you can pick up on this. I think if someone comes over to a market, they might see something that they're sensitive to. It's kind of like being sensitive to a certain spectrum, a certain part of the spectrum, right? It doesn't mean the other part of the spectrum doesn't exist or is even bigger, right? So, you know, you may be sensitive to infrared, you know, but there's a whole nother spectrum you're missing. So you may see that English because you're sensitive to it and you think there's a big market, and you may think a lot of businesses here are really looking for that English. A lot of people are using English all the time. But in reality, that may be very small compared to, well, in this case, Chinese, Taiwanese, Hakka, and the languages that are used for business every day all of the time, and the things that's used for marketing. You may just see that. James, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think absolutely, because I think that particularly if you come from the West, your mindset is around the universality of English and how that's so critical to getting business done.
Especially if you're American,
right?
And well, if you're British as well, you know, if you speak more than one language and you're a Brit, then you're a genius, you know.
Well, I mean, to be off, we're just exaggerating. There, you know, a lot of people learning a lot of language. A lot of Americans come over and learn a lot of Chinese.
Sure.
We just had Robert on the show a couple of weeks ago, an expert linguist in Chinese. But yeah, I think marketing, James, I don't see many marketing people that have this kind of perspective.
That's right. And I think the great point that you've made here is there's so many different motivations for learning language, and the fact that we keep mentioning these cram schools. And what do the kids go to learn in the cram schools? Well, they're going to learn how to pass the test most of the time, and the scores and getting the right score in English is much more of a badge of honor and a badge of appropriateness and a badge of requirement, really, for moving forward.
Yeah. Real
which
motivator.
Really reflects what a lot of language is all about. It's a lot about testing, it's a lot about getting the right score, and it's often not so much about actual language in use. And I think we've talked a lot as well about some of the economic factors that drive that, and where people see increasing numbers of jobs in China rather than in international trade. That kind of then again reduces the importance and the mindset towards language for use rather than language for a test. And you know, that all then makes it much more of a whim of government and the whim of testing and testing policy rather than real language in use. So I think when you start to unpick it from that point of view, the market foundation becomes really kind of quite different, really.
Yeah,
so I think that's one of
the
key messages from Marketer.
Yeah.
That you know, we're looking almost through that glass lens that suddenly can just break in front of your eyes there.
Yeah, I think in a matter of time, it's going to really, that shifting is just going to continue, because James, you must see this, and Michael, you must see this in the schools you've worked at. Like, we're hiring more and more people who are locally educated. PhD
yep.
programs are good, but they're good in things like statistics, mathematics. They're not getting English, and there's no real reason for them to.
No.
And they, you know, we get, so that, you know, you're getting a different level at the university of people. Their quality is good, but it's just not going to be oriented towards the U.S. It's going to be oriented towards Taiwan and the market in Taiwan and
yeah.
the big companies in Taiwan and the China market, the greater China region.
Even the teachers who come back, they're not teaching in English.
Yeah.
They're teaching in Chinese.
Right, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, for me, I would say one important lesson here is that localize.
Yeah.
When you got a product here, it has to be in Taiwan. It has to be localized. Has to be presented in a way that the locals can appreciate and interact with. And English is just not that kind of product in many ways.
You know, I think a lot of foreigners have the assumption of that kind of country of origin, especially Americans.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your experience on that?
I think America as a country of origin has no weight at all in Taiwan.
No weight at all.
Very, very little.
You see, I think when a foreigner comes and they turn on the TV in the hotel they're in, they see Disney, they think it's Disney. But it's hard for me to explain to them that it's not Disney, because it's so localized. Because they don't understand the Chinese advertisement.
Right.
They don't understand the announcers. And they don't understand the Chinese that's changed the English.
Yes, yes. The way the translation...
The way it's been translated.
The presentation with the high-pitched, cute voices.
Right.
And
the reason
stuff.
Disney succeeds
totally
is because there's really great businessmen up in Taipei who know how to change that translation to tap into the Taiwan market. I think a good example is a lot of Japanese shows. They do it better. They
yeah,
do it much better.
They do a
great
better. Job.
So you get things like Woman Zei Jia. Have you seen this one from
Japan? No,
I've never
seen that one.
It's our family. We've got a couple clips on the website because it's so funny. But they take the Japanese and they translate it to Chinese. But they use Chinese that people use in Taiwan all the time, and it's mixed with Taiwanese.
No way.
So
that's
local,
yeah.
And yet it's a Japanese product.
Yeah.
And every kid knows it. Every kid knows every scene. James, you and I we had a Line show, remember? I talked to my daughter, who loves the show, and she said, hey, there's a scene from that show about Lines. Get this scene. She knew the exact show, the exact scene. And I don't think she'd know any Disney show like that. Although
no.
She'll know the Disney show, but it won't be that kind of thing.
Right.
So I think Michael's right on it. Localize, which is what we always talk about in this show. And we always want to say focus, 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 localize.
Yeah,
is there an easy way to localize, Michael?
I wish there were, but you got to have locals doing it.
which means we another it kind of puts us out of a job.
That's right. I think you know, another thing that we're seeing this trend is what I was just blogging on today, the bifurcating economy of Taiwan. Mm-hmm. As the small businesses have shifted to China, the technology businesses and the export economy are booming, and they're outwardly focused, and they're in the north. So even this bifurcation is regional. A lot of foreigners, they only stop in the north. They go to Taipei, maybe they go to Hsinchu, and they encounter people who speak English, and who can, when they see these foreigners, they can adopt this mask of modernity, to use your wonderful phrase, Clyde, and they can deal with them because they know what foreigners expect to deal with.
Right.
And so foreigners simply are fed, they receive as feedback the image which they expect to perceive when they come to Taiwan.
Yeah, I think the best example of that is going to a bar.
Yeah.
You know, you go to a bar that's Western oriented, you're going to see Chinese there that are Western oriented.
Yeah, they all speak English.
They're going to speak English to you, you speak English to them, and you all reinforce each other's kind of feeling. I think a good analogy would be hanging out like in a bar in New York City. Everyone there is going to present themselves as a, you know, very
American,
hip New Yorker, right? You know, nobody there is from Illinois or Tennessee. You know, they're all New Yorkers and they're very hip, you know. But of course, none of them really are, right?
Right.
And that's not the wider market. Okay, well, we'll wrap it up for this show. I think we're going to have a research follow-up on this show, and we're going to talk a detailed research that I and some other researchers have done. But this is the kind of the general economic trend.
Yeah.
Last word.
James, over to you.
James, localize. Localize, localize.
Yeah,
great. Yeah, I would think that the best example would be if somebody could watch some of those Japanese cartoons. The Japanese industry has become so good.
Yeah, localizing here in Taiwan. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the message for the provider in the localization is the fact that learning the language to use it may not be the big motivation here, and that it's so don't get too sort of idealistic about what your students are coming to learn the language for. And then in terms of marketing it, exactly, all these things become so real, and the more localized they are and more connected up with the reality underlying motivations for learning the language, the more it's going to click and make much more sense. And I think, Clyde, we should be getting into this when we talk on the research show in a lot more detail. That should be good.
Yeah, we're going to have a lot more detail on how we've surveyed users, consumers about this, and some deep psychological perspectives of it. So I want to thank Michael Turton for being a special guest host on our show. It's really great to have you. And I want to remind everyone, take a visit over to Michael's blog and/or webpage. And the webpage is pretty spread out. It's got a lot of stuff on there. MichaelTurton.blogspot.com and also MichaelTurton.com.
Yeah.
And I think you'll get a big kick out of that. And definitely, I think my advice is you've got to get an RSS reader. Because if you don't have an RSS reader, you're going to be scrolling his page all the time. You definitely got to get a reader to get his stuff, because a lot of stuff going on there and very, very interesting. Okay, then that's it. Wrap it up. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
This is Talk of Asian Marketing with a special emphasis on localized Chinese consumer behavior. Meow, 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 meow